All right, so let me grab everybody's attention here. I'm going to open us in prayer here in just a second, but welcome to the fourth and final of our mental health series as we, this year, as Sola Church, has faced into serving the vulnerable. We just wanted to take some time to learn about the mind, mental health, the brain, how it works and functions, and how we can then better love our neighbors. And I just keep on, after each one of these sessions, I feel like my response has been twofold. There's the tension of the already not yet, right? Like we both, I both have found myself responding with how we are fearfully and wonderfully made, and every new wave of discovery shows us another layer of how God has designed us to work. But at the same time, with all of those, brokenness has penetrated down through all of those layers. And so as we, as believers, are pressing into the cumulative corruption of sin, we want to continue learning and understanding and growing, but also continue believing that Jesus can fully restore these things. So I'm going to introduce Michael. I'm going to pray for us here in a second. This is Michael Everson here. He is a he's a Denver Seminary grad with his MA from Denver Seminary in counseling, and I'll let him kind of explain a little bit more about what he does and what his credentials are. But he has spent time facing into this and learning about it, especially as it relates to addiction, which is what our last topic is tonight. And just in the brief time I've had to be able to talk with him, he seems to understand the unique challenges that people from church cultures may face when examining our own lives, but also examining and working and loving our neighbors well who are wrestling with these things. So I hope you can give him your attention, be open to the Spirit and what he might be saying to us tonight, what he might want us to learn tonight, because he has brought us here. He's in control. He's wise. He's brought us here to engage with this topic tonight. So please be open to all of that. But please, as we go through this tonight, remember that Jesus' resurrection power goes all the way. And so just the passage that has come to mind to me today is that in Romans 8, it says that creation groans and we groan along with it, that brokenness is deep and we have angst and we groan because of it. But Jesus' resurrection power promises us that that's not the forever reality, and that our wrestling with brokenness now actually matters in light of who he is and what he's done and where he's going with all of this. So let's pray together as we face into this tonight and ask the Spirit to help us learn what he's called us here to learn today. God, we worship you because you are great. Man, you created everything. You sustain everything, Jesus, by the word of your power. You are in all of the minutiae. Every little atom and subatomic particle that exists is known by you. And every galaxy that is beyond our wildest imagination is also controlled by you and upheld by you. So you are in the details of all of these things. You understand them. You know them. We don't have to be afraid of what we don't understand yet, because we know you and we can trust you. But as you lead us forward, help us to know how we are to interact. Help us to know how we are to interact with creation. Help us to know how we are to interact with our neighbors. Help us to know how we're to interact with our own selves as we consider the brokenness that we've experienced and seen. And may you, as we learn more and more about these things, may you continually remind us of the hope that we have in the full restoration of all that you own, especially us. We are your people, and you've promised to raise us spiritual bodies which are going to look into your glory. And we can't even imagine right now the future glory that you have prepared for us. So as we consider the present suffering that we experience, physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, may we remember that, Jesus, you entered into these things with us, and that you walk alongside us even as you're redeeming us out of them to something that's beautiful and glorious. Please be with Michael tonight as he speaks. May your Spirit be on him to be able to communicate the things that we need to know and that we need to discover and need to continue to grow in tonight. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. One quick note before I give this over to him. So you've got papers on your tables here. Michael's going to share with us for a while, and then we're going to have some time of interactive questioning. If you have questions, please write them on those papers, and we'll just go around and gather some of those, and I'll hand those off to him, and he can answer those. That doesn't mean you can't shout stuff out, but just to kind of help us in a little more organized way get questions answered thoughtfully, please make use of those papers. All right. Thanks, Michael. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Rob. Hey, would you mind passing everybody out one of those? Thank you. All right. Michael Everson. I am very, very excited to be here this evening. Jamie Weir, who I got to work with at Southeast Christian Counseling Center, mentioned this, and it's pretty much everything I want to do. I love the Bible, and I am very passionate about mental health and addictions. So when they said, do you want to present on both, it was, of course. And I happen to know a lot on these topics. I don't know everything, but I've kind of prepared kind of a journey, really. And so that's part of it is not that I don't want any questions on the way, but I kind of want to take you all the way through it. And then at the end, if there's any questions, I would love to feel those. And understand, just like Rob said, this can be a difficult topic, and this is something that is definitely a problem in our society. And yeah, hopefully we can get a little more understanding this evening. Okay, so I had a request to share the letters behind my name. Valid. So yes, I got a master's in clinical counseling from Denver Seminary. That's the MA. LPC is a licensed professional counselor. So that would be pretty much the main credential in the counseling world that you'd be looking for your general counseling. And then I specialized in addictions counseling, so that's the licensed addictions counselor. The biblical integration counselor is, that's probably my favorite part of all this, because I truly believe that the Bible is God's word, and it is transforming, it is alive, and it is necessary to be a part of situations. Now, that doesn't mean everybody I work with is a Christian. I work with a lot of secular people. And in those situations, because I have all these letters, I can't evangelize. I can't necessarily push them into it. I have to work with their core value system. But I'll reference that a bunch more. Southeast Christian Counseling Center, it's a fantastic counseling center in Parker. We have a variety of different disciplines there and specialties. And so that's, my niche is kind of Bible integration and addictions. So just a quick, very, very shortened version of my career journey. It'll actually take us through a lot of the different treatments that I'll explain later. So Denver Seminary internship, this is back in about 2010. I had an internship at a counseling center where I worked with teenage addiction, adult addiction. We would run groups, and one of the groups, happened to be for adopted children who were struggling with drug use. And so I know that, in some of the previous talks that they referenced that. And yeah, that's a very difficult population to work with. And definitely they are hurting in a variety of ways beyond the addiction. We've talked about attachment disorders and all kinds of stuff. So that was a very difficult kind of a proving ground where I was able to kind of be there. And God has just, for some reason, given me a passion to work with addiction and people who are struggling with it. I graduated around 2012, and my first job, I couldn't find a counseling job right out of the gate. I've got my master's, and the only job I could find was in a detox treatment center, which I don't know how many people are aware of what those are like, but they're pretty awful. It's about the most miserable place in the world. If you get a DUI, that's where they take you. And you are there, and you are locked in there until you blow a 0.0 for your blood alcohol content. And it's hours. If you have a 0.10 blood alcohol content, it would take 10 hours. So they would be in this facility for 10 hours. And I would breathalyze them on the hour. I also wiped down urine-soaked mattresses and processed, homeless people and all the things that I think that we're definitely, if not for, my walk with Jesus, I felt very in line with my core value system and loving the people who were hurting the most. But it wasn't exactly counseling. I didn't get to really engage them on that level because they were intoxicated. So I worked out of that and into more of an outpatient treatment center. So outpatient, intensive outpatient. Treatment would be if you go and see a counselor once a week or twice a week, that would be outpatient. If you need more care, then you would see somebody maybe 9 hours a week. That would be intensive outpatient. So I got a lot of experience in there. Inpatient treatment is for the people that are in a facility for 30, 60, 90 days. And that's each one of those requires a different kind of counseling style. After that, I moved into a position with National Institute for Change, which is kind of more on this side of town. And they service the forensic population for counseling, which just basically means people who have some kind of a criminal charge, right? So whether it's domestic violence or substance abuse or possession. So drug court is actually a really interesting program. It would be for somebody who has a felony drug offense, but they are trying to work out of going to prison. So they're very motivated in a lot of ways, and this is what's on the line. Now the success rate is really depressingly low. And despite having intensive outpatient treatment and a variety of people from judges to lawyers to probation officers involved, it's still a really low thing. So recidivism would be if you have offended and then would reoffend within the criminal justice system. And unfortunately, it's an extremely high number, but it is less expensive than jail, and it actually has a higher success rate. But we're still talking in maybe like the single digits as far as percentages. Then I got on at Southeast Christian Counseling Center, which is primarily an outpatient facility, and I jokingly refer to it as Disneyland for therapists because it is pretty much one of the best places I've ever worked. We have fantastic leadership, and as far as getting to engage people who want to have the Bible included, it's right up my alley. So that's where I'm at, and that's where I plan to stay for a while. Okay, so I'll re-reference some of these different things as we go on, but just kind of wanted you to understand. I've had the benefit, really, I honestly feel like the Lord guided me through this path. I probably wouldn't have chosen it, but it really gave me experience at every single level to really understand what people are dealing with. So objectives of tonight, I would like for you all to understand different types of addiction and different types of therapy to treat addiction. I'd like for you to gain a better understanding of how addiction affects the brain, because that's going to be a big part of this. Learn how to help those with addiction, and I really appreciate what the leaders of Sola Church are doing here, because it's an incredibly difficult thing to go through, suffering with an addiction, and it's incredibly difficult to help somebody, whether you're family, friends, or anything. And I am so encouraged by the leadership inviting me here to do this and putting all of these on, because I think it's an incredibly important thing for the church to learn how to care for people who are suffering. So we'll touch on that. How to develop empathy in various situations. I don't know if anybody, I won't ask for your hands, but I think a lot of people in here would say, I could never understand why somebody would do that, why they would do heroin. Why would they shoot it into their veins? Why would you drink alcohol when your marriage is on the line? Right? Why would you do these things? There's no concept of that. And so I would like to work into that empathy. And empathy, we would just kind of outline as sympathy would say, okay, yeah, I get it. I drank it a lot, in college, and it was really hard to stop, and then I got out of it. That would be sympathy. I had the experience, right? I'm talking about empathy. In that, you may not have been downtown by the river buying heroin from a drug dealer around all the homeless people. There's no way to understand that. But empathy is saying, can I put myself in their shoes? Can I try and understand what led them to that point without judging them as some terrible, horrible addict? You'll hear I'll refer to it as people who suffer from addiction as opposed to addicts, right? And then some biblical application at the end. Okay, so addiction statistics. Honestly, there is a flood of addiction statistics. I think we're all aware this is a gigantic problem. And there's infinitely more that would go along with this, but these are just kind of some of the basics, right? Almost 21 million Americans have at least one addiction, yet only 10% of them receive treatment. If you think about nicotine addiction, alcohol addiction, marijuana addiction, these are all legal substances if you're over 21, right? So yeah, in a lot of cases, this is societally condoned behavior, right? Drug overdose deaths have more than tripled since 1990. From 99 to 17, more than 700,000 Americans died from overdosing from a drug. Alcohol and drug addiction cost the US economy over $600 billion every year. When I worked, it was Arapahoe House was when I was working with the detox facility, and they would just have kind of repeat customers, to be honest. They would be homeless people that they didn't want to put in jail because when you're coming off of alcohol, you might have seizures, you might vomit, you might choke on that. And so a lot of it was just really making sure we're checking them, almost on a medical level. But they would just keep coming back and they had no money to pay for it. And the government funded a lot of Arapahoe House until it didn't, and now it's closed. 2017, 34.2 million Americans committed DUIs, 21.4 million under the influence of alcohol, and 12.8 million under the influence of drugs. I don't like thinking about when I'm driving around on Fridays, Saturday nights. I don't like thinking about how many people are out there having over-consumed. But it's a guarantee that people you're driving around have, right? And I don't want to freak anybody out. But having worked with this population, I worked with people who, got DUIs, and they would need to do court-mandated therapy. And a lot of them, they would say, 100% clarity, I have no problem. I have no, alcohol problem whatsoever. And then working with felony DUI people, so that would be around five or more, that said the exact same thing. So we'll get into the insidious nature of drug abuse and how deceiving it is and how deceived the people who are under its spell are. About 20% of Americans who have depression or anxiety disorders also have substance use disorders. We would call this co-occurring disorders, which is pretty common. And I bet that that's actually probably a low number in terms of a lot of people don't get diagnosed with depression, anxiety, bipolar, PTSD, more trauma-based. So I think it would be a much, much higher number if people really understood what the mental health issues were in play. And so for the most part, when we talk about addiction, we're often talking about this word coping. So if somebody has anxiety, right, if they suffer from anxiety, they're racing thoughts or they feel like their heart's beating too fast, they might often just drink. They'll drink alcohol because it's a depressant. That'll slow their mind down or basically shut it off. And that's coping, right? They don't know how to slow it down themselves. And often this starts in teenage years, and so they don't even know what it's like to just endure an anxiety attack. They just drink and shut it down. More than 90% of people who have an addiction started to drink alcohol or use drugs before they were 18 years old. I think in learning a lot about the brain science of this, it's, our brains are developing into our even kind of mid to late 20s. And so these are developing brains, and we'll talk a little bit more about the neural pathways that they're creating. But as teenagers, if you're drinking regularly, you are setting up a future, basically a super highway of how to deal with life, right? So I had a great day, I'm gonna drink. Had a terrible day, I'm gonna drink. My wife's yelling at me, I'm gonna drink. A lot of that stuff started back in high school when, I don't know about if any of you struggled in high school, when you are a teenager, it's like you got the hormones going, and it is a very difficult time for people. If teenagers don't learn how to cope with those emotions then, you'll often see in adults they can't cope with their emotions then either, and that's part of the problem. Americans between the age of 18 and 25 are most likely to use addictive drugs. Okay, so addiction is much more than you think. And I submit that I stand in a room full of addicts. And by the time we're done here, we're all going to be a little uncomfortable, so just be aware. What do you feel when you see this, right? Brain chemistry is at play. I am an admitted coffee dependent at this point. If I don't drink it, my body feels terrible. And I know that that's the case, but I'm not ruining my life because of it, right? So it would be one of those more acceptable addictions, but it is nevertheless a horribly addictive substance. Sugar. It's very socially acceptable, right? It's very innocent looking, but these are profoundly addictive substances. That's a little bit more addictive. Makes a little more sense. Gambling, which often goes along with drinking, these are all brain chemistry type of addictions. I don't know, I don't have that problem, but exercise would be, that would be a great thing to be addicted to, and I would like to take that up at some point. This is where it gets a little uglier, right? When we're talking about opiate addiction and we are talking about intravenous drug use, it gets a whole lot more dangerous. And we're talking about a whole lot more death, a whole lot more, you know, disease being passed around. And this is when it really starts to get bad. So, common types of addiction, substance, which we saw some of. Pornography is probably one of the most insidious addictions that has run like wildfire through our world, and we don't even know it. And that's part of the problem. If I am drinking too much, it's visible. You can see it, right? It's poison, honestly. It starts to take its toll on your physical appearance. You'll start getting sloppy. You'll start driving drunk. You'll start, you know, saying really awful things. It's visible at that point. Pornography can go undercover for decades. And a lot of my work actually ends up being with people who struggle with pornography. Because as a, you know, licensed professional, I am bound by confidentiality. So somebody can come and talk to me, and they would be able to say, I am profoundly addicted to pornography. I can't stop doing it. The statistics on that are kind of interesting, because even the secular world is coming to understand that it is having an effect, right? So I'm blanking on the term. But basically, yeah, there's sexual, you know, disorders that come from that. There is an inability to have sex that comes along with that, an inability to have intimacy. And so now as the world's catching up to this, we have these cell phones that are basically supercomputers, and they are pumping pornography into our lives. I mean, even just the statistics on kids under 10, right? As they are looking at this, they are having neural pathways created in their brain for something that they don't even have a concept of, right? They haven't even gone through puberty. But their brain is already wired for this stuff. So we're gonna touch on that a little bit more as well. Sex, you know, physical sex, you know, we would get into more of the sex would be the, you know, when you're having sex, this is a God-given thing. This is a beautiful thing, right? When it's done within marriage, as prescribed. But it's still pleasurable outside of that, but it gets more and more extreme, especially for people who struggle with sex addiction, and that's when there's disease involved, they're breaking apart their relationships, they're persisting in very high-risk behavior. Gambling, do we have any gamblers in the room? Anybody play cards? Anybody go up to Blackhawk? All right, that's good. No, don't do that. For the most part, gambling seems very innocent in a way, right? You're playing a $20 cash poker game at your friend's house. Yeah, no big deal, right? You go up to Blackhawk, and people who would have an addiction in this would be somebody that would say, all right, I'm going to just do $100, and they lose $100, and they go to the ATM and get more. And they go to the ATM and get more, and they can't stop themselves. And a lot of the people I work with a gambling addiction have pretty much gambled away, you know, kids' college funds. They've gambled away mortgage payments. They have gambled away everything that their family needed to survive. And they did it all while knowing it was a bad thing. Food, you know, that's another socially acceptable one. Body image, that's actually a really scary one that I don't have a lot of experience with, but I know that can very much be an addiction, very much a controlling behavior in an attempt to cope with that lack of control. And this is another one that I get on my soapbox about, but social media and phones and these screens. And I don't feel like this is an understatement, but if a child has a smartphone, I swear to you that it's like giving them meth. Like, it is way too much for their little minds to contain. Like, if you've ever seen a small child and try and take their screen away, like, it can be really difficult. And some of them actually start acting like addicts, right? They get all crazy in the eyes and they might throw a tantrum. Or this is something that, as I think we'll see as society goes on, that this is a real problem. Screens are a problem. Teenagers, right, they talk about this, you know, whole increase in the suicide rate, right? The dawn of social media, these kids have grown up with it. And this is a problem because they can't ever turn off this social thing. They can get bullied at a distance now. They can feel isolated even, you know, when they're at home, where in the past, right, I grew up in the 90s, you know, we didn't even have cell phones. It was fantastic. I wish we could go back to this time. So they're amazing inventions, incredible. They can, you know, I love my phone. I can look up scripture, and it can also look up the most deviant, awful pornography in the world too. And so just like alcohol, just like coffee, just like, you know, screens, we're not trying to demonize these things, right? Some of you may enjoy alcohol. Okay, that's your call. If you feel like you can drink in moderation, if you don't drink to drunkenness, which I think can sometimes be a little ambiguous, I think people are wine connoisseurs. I mean, the craft beers in Denver are pretty intense, and people really are into that. Okay, fine. You know, if you can get on your screen and not look at pornography, use it appropriately, that's great. But a lot of people can't, and they're not talking about it, and so this sin and this addiction is going under the surface. And once it does that, it gets weirder, it gets uglier, and it gets bigger, and it does more damage. Okay, so levels of treatment. So whenever we're talking about somebody having an addiction to any of these things, you know, in a lot of ways we would be, maybe this is a good time for this. So I've got the diagnostic manual. So anybody who's gone and seen a counselor might have seen this. This is kind of the go-to book in terms of people really looking into diagnosis. I'm not a huge, you know, fan of diagnosis in that I don't want to put labels on someone, but if it is fitting, it does really help with a course of therapy. So we want to be really careful about diagnosis while at the same time, also identifying the problem. So I'm just going to read a few of these symptoms that would go along with what we would call alcohol use disorder. And once again, yeah, play at home for fun. You can check yourself on these things, right? If anybody does consume alcohol, if anybody does have a vice of any kind, these would be the very similar things that we would talk about in any kind of addiction. So alcohol is taken in larger amounts over a longer period of time than was intended. There's a persistent desire or unsuccessful efforts to cut down alcohol use or control it. Great deal of time is spent in activities necessary to obtain alcohol, use it, or recover from its effects. Craving or strong desire or urge to use alcohol. Recurrent alcohol use resulting in a failure to fulfill major role obligations at work, school, or home. Continued alcohol use despite having persistent, recurrent social and interpersonal problems caused or exacerbated by the effects of alcohol. Important social, occupational, recreational activities are given up or reduced because of alcohol use. Recurrent alcohol use in situations in which it is physically hazardous, also known as driving, and a variety of others. Alcohol use is continued despite knowledge of having a persistent or recurrent physical or psychological problem that is likely to have been caused or exacerbated by alcohol. And that's one of the really complicated ones, is often you'll have somebody who is, you know, just profoundly addicted to alcohol, which is a depressant. Now, are these people depressed? Maybe, but how would we know, right? Their brain chemistry is altered by the substance, which we'll get into here in a little bit. How in the world are you gonna find a way to diagnose this person, right? Do they need depression medication, or do they need to get off of the substance, right? This is very complicated. Tolerance, as defined by one of the following: need for markedly increased amounts of alcohol to achieve intoxication or desired effect, diminished effect with continued use of the same amount of alcohol. with any drug, the first use is the pinnacle, right? It's all downhill from there. And unfortunately, it's a slow decline, so people still feel that rush, they still feel that exhilaration. However, it's kind of, they would call it chasing the dragon. It's just this concept of you'll never have that same thing, and you're always chasing that, the feeling of that first use. And withdrawal, also known as hangovers. There's a variety of things that go along with that, but headaches, nausea, and I think anybody who's ever had too much to drink, unfortunately, knows about that one. You're tired, and basically that's your body saying, don't do that. This is poison, right? So you could apply that list to any addiction, and if you are thinking through that on your own, it wouldn't take more than 3 to get a diagnosis of alcohol use disorder, and it wouldn't take more than 6 to be a severe alcohol use disorder. Most of the people I meet with, they would say, I don't have a problem, and then we would read the list, and they would say, that was 11 out of 11. What's that? And so, yeah, that's severe, right? And that's amazing. Like the whole concept of functional alcoholic, these are people who go to work, they maintain relationships. Some of these things are getting ticked off at the time, but they're able to navigate it for a time. But as they continue, as the use gets greater, as their tolerance gets greater, eventually it will break down and they will start to show more of the effects. So I would say that the functional alcoholic is temporary. So when diagnosing, right? So if somebody says, yep, I got all 11 and I'm drinking way too much every day, I can't stop, we would start talking about what are some, good things to go to, right? So first one I would talk about is peer support groups. This would be your Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous. There's tons of anonymouses, Sex Addicts Anonymous. There's the whole thing. These are people who also struggle with the disease or just struggle with the addiction, and they would just like to all come together, right? So nobody's an expert, nobody's paid. They typically use their own personal experience. The big book, interestingly enough, the 12 steps for Alcoholics Anonymous is based on biblical principles, or basically Jesus' teaching to the 12 apostles. And so a lot of it follows through that. So that can be really helpful for some people. A lot of times if somebody's resistant to that, we might need a higher level, right? But in my work, I would always like for somebody to be a part of a peer support group anyway, because I think it's one of the many things that can be helpful. Celebrate recovery for those people who have Christian core values. It's just a more focused Christian form of AA. AA, it can be your higher power, it can be anything. So step one, you have to admit you're powerless against the substance. That suggest maybe I can adopt, there is a higher power that I can appeal to. For some people, they might say it's society, right? Just laws. There's my higher power. They can come up with a variety of things. But celebrate recovery, I have a lot of clients who do that, and it's very, very helpful to them to just know they're in it with people who are struggling the same way. Outpatient therapy, that's where I'm at currently. I would meet with clients 1 to 2 times a week. And we would create plans. We would talk through, variety of just any mental health disorder. I meet with couples. I meet with kind of older teenagers. We have other people that meet with kind of the younger teenagers. But the outpatient facility is great. However, it's not cheap to meet with me. With all the training and everything that went into it, oftentimes, especially, down in Douglas County, which is a very, wealthy area, then oftentimes people don't have that ability to access the treatment. Now, one of my favorite things about Southeast Counseling is Southeast Christian Church is a big mega church over there, and they give literally millions of dollars to the counseling center. So if somebody says, I can't pay your full rate, say, what can you pay? And we work with them. And I think just having done my addiction work and having been with the people who are at their lowest spot, I think that I still have that heart for people, and this is why it's Disneyland to me, because I get to do everything I want in one place. So intensive outpatient, this is once again about the 9-hour a week thing, right? So somebody tries the peer, it doesn't work. Somebody's coming weekly, it's not working. Maybe they need a higher level of care. We would bump it up to a intensive outpatient. So that would be probably 3 groups and an individual session, and that would be every week for a good season of their life, you know, and hopefully they could then step back down into outpatient and move forward. Inpatient, I don't know if any of you have seen those, you know, some of the infomercials or commercials about these places in Malibu, and they're beautiful and expensive and amazing, and probably anybody would just have a great 90 days there. I'd need 90 days there, just in general. But who can afford this, right? This is thousands, if not like $100,000, right? There are plenty of these different, things around Denver, these inpatient therapy centers, but it's very difficult, right? Basically, what we're saying is you can't stop drinking, then we have to remove you, right? We have to remove all temptation. We're going to put you somewhere for 30, 60, 90 days, and you're going to go through the whole deal. You're going to have group therapy, you're going to have individual therapy, you're going to have a lot of time alone to think, right? Oftentimes phones, family, you know, everything is kind of stripped away at this point. Because what we really want for the person to do is start to accept their own control, right? The fact that they still do have a measure of control in all of this. Alternative methods, and some of these can be quite controversial. I don't know if anybody saw the show Intervention. It was a little while back. It was one of those shows where somebody is just way into drugs and they are not getting out. They don't see it. They're just kind of doing their thing. Their families might be enabling them for a while. And then one day they say, okay, we're going to go to this person, right? A therapist. I don't do interventions, but there are people in Denver that do. And they would say, okay, we're going to schedule this whole thing. We're going to get friends, family, people. We're going to write letters. We're going to confront the addiction and basically say, hey, you get to choose right now. Either you lose relationship with all of us and you go to this center, if you want to keep using, you lose relationship with all of us. If you want to go to this center, then we will help you. We will still be in your life. We'll be along for the journey. And in a way, it does kind of sound like church discipline, right? Which I think is kind of a taboo subject. But there is a concept of if somebody is lost in sin, they are unwilling to stop, they are unrepentant, and they are in a church body, there is a protocol for that. And is it loving to threaten to take away a relationship if that person is truly in a dangerous position? And lots of thoughts on that. We won't get into that today. But that's what an intervention is, right? That's kind of that moment of like, this person is headed the wrong direction. We have to put a stop to it. Harm reduction, that's kind of the controversial thing. I don't know, has anybody heard of harm reduction before? No. So in some ways you have, you just maybe didn't know the term. So that would be like giving, you know, condoms to kids in high school, right? It's the concept is like, well, abstinence, we're not gonna get that done. So let's at least make sure it's safe. Right? I visited clean needle programs, right? So they would say, okay, they're not going to stop using heroin or drugs anytime soon, so let's give them clean needles, because then at least they're not, you know, passing around disease, right? People don't like this. Some people feel like this, why would you encourage something so terrible, right? And that's logical, like, why would you do that? So a lot of advocates for that would say, you know, at least now we're not spreading HIV around the city. Or at least we are, you know, not having a bunch of unplanned pregnancies and that may lead to abortions. And so in a lot of ways, we would also call harm reduction sometimes substance replacement, especially working with the really the profoundly addicted people. Sometimes they would start chain smoking cigarettes, right? They'd be sober off the drugs, but they would be smoking more than ever. And we would say, it's not heroin. Don't love it. That's not where we're going. And when I talk about the brain chemistry, it's problematic still, but nevertheless, that's something that they might use to cope. And when we were in drug court, we would say, try and make it temporarily, try and move them down that road. Medically assisted treatment. Once you kind of cross a line with some of these, you know, substances, like whether it's heroin, you know, and you're withdrawing, and the withdrawal symptoms from heroin make it feel like you're dying, but you're not. You're not going to die, but you're going to feel like you are, and you're going to want to probably. And so a lot of the times, like in the detox centers, these people would be, you know, there for days, you know, 3-4 days, vomiting, nauseous, unable to move, unable to get up, unable to do anything, right? So medically assisted treatment, alcohol, that's another one. You can drink so much alcohol that the body, this is how incredible, you know, God's creation and the body is. The body can accommodate pretty much any substance. So people can drink so much that the body basically has to turn over and depend upon it to survive at a certain point. So sometimes people are getting off, and if they were to not drink, they would have seizures, they would be in intense pain, and it would be almost deadly to the point of where they could die without it. And that's crazy to I think, the mind, but at the same time, this is something that happens. Okay, so when we're talking about that, right, so motivation to change, this is a really difficult thing. So a lot of people don't want to change. So maybe if you get your DUI, you get an intervention held on you are not ready to quit, but you have been basically threatened with, you are going to jail, you are going to lose your family, and now it's time to do something about it, right? So, you know, external motivation would be kind of that forensic population, right? You've got this legal system that's pushing on you, you know, the intervention, maybe it's a spouse, maybe it's a job, maybe, you know, it's just something, someone is telling you to stop. Internal motivation would be, now I'm ready to change. And this is difficult, because even in outpatient therapy like I do, people will pay money to come in, and they may not be ready to change, they feel like they have to. And I know the difference when somebody's motivated to change, they put together the plan, they move forward, and a lot of times we have to really be patient with them, because we want that internal motivation. Sometimes it starts external, but ultimately, some people need to get locked up first. Some people need to lose everything before they really hit rock bottom and really understand the need to change. So, here's some controversy. We'll get the ball rolling. Choice model, when it comes to addiction, is kind of that concept of like, well, just choose to stop, right? It's not that big a deal. You're the one putting it up to your lips. You're the one buying it. You're the one seeking it. It's got a real willpower focus, right? If I'm really strong enough, right? And in faith communities, I've heard this a lot, is, well, if you just had more faith, you know, if you just had more faith, if you read your Bible more, if you were like more part of the community, you just wouldn't do that. You know, it's a sin. Like, you're sinning right now, and you're choosing to sin. And this gets a little confusing for them in a lot of ways, because they agree with you, but they're still drawn to it. They're still doing it despite what they know is true and what they're hearing. The old school addiction treatment, this would be kind of more of your AAs, but even as we kind of got into more of the professional addiction counseling, it would often be ex-addicts who are saying, I got sober this way, now you get sober this way, right? This is the way home, come follow me. A lot of challenge, a lot of aggressive confrontation. And even early in my career, I got to see a little bit of that and work with some of these therapists. And it was just vastly different than what I was taught at Denver Seminary. This is kind of more new school addiction, which would be the disease model. So basic summary of that, addiction is a brain disease. This is all in the brain chemistry. It is characterized by altered brain structure and functioning. These brain abnormalities cause people with this disease to become addicted to substances, activities once exposed to these substances, or activity occurs. So we'll get into some of the brain stuff. So now, I am by no means a biologist, and I understand this on a very basic level. But in our brains, we have these neurotransmitters, right? And these things are connecting, you know, our memories, our thoughts, our experiences. You know, if the small child puts their hand on the stove and it burns them, okay, you know, they just created a neural pathway, right? Don't touch that thing again, because it's basically about survival, right? Don't touch the thing that hurts me, right? So it goes the other way too. So when we've got the neural pathways or the neurotransmitters, so as one neurotransmitter releases what we would call dopamine, which is kind of the main one we would focus on. So dopamine is associated with pleasure. So this is just the simplified version. When one neurotransmitter releases dopamine, there are receptors in the other. And when we're talking about just things naturally occurring, right, you might have a delicious, you know, dessert, right? Or you might have a really good workout. Or you might have, you know, sex, right, would be the very top, right? So sex releases the most dopamine naturally. But then you might have your thrill seekers jumping out of planes, and then you've got these your favorite meals, and you got all this. And this is all in the normal range, right? And so people, you know, we want to feel pleasure, sure. So they get released, they get taken back in, and it's all very like a clean system, right? Now what happens with substance abuse, and this is what kind of gets a little scary, is that it would take the neurotransmitter. And a lot of this is expectation-based, right? So if you had some meth rocks, you know, and you're looking at these things, you're like, this does not look good to me. This does not look pleasurable. Like, I don't know what this is. Your brain is taking in this data. Now you use it, you smoke it, you inject it, and now all of a sudden, it floods your brain with so much dopamine, you can't even think straight, right? This is the euphoria, right? So all those little red dots, it's just pumping it out, right? It's pumping it out at a rate that doesn't, it's not natural. And actually with stimulants like meth and cocaine, it would block the receivers. And so it would actually just leave all this dopamine in the synaptic gap, the gap in between. And this is why something like meth, you could use meth one time and it creates this neural pathway where it went, these meth rocks look nothing, right? But it is the best feeling you've ever had in your life times a billion, right? And so your brain says, oh, well, if this is that good, then you know, let's do more of this, right? So it's creating this neural pathway that says, I need to do more. It depends, you know, the kind of the depressants like heroin and alcohol, they may not block the neurotransmitters, but they would definitely pump out a lot of the dopamine. Right, and so part of this is there won't be as much dopamine as that very first use, and that's what's happening is your brain's accommodating, it's changing, and that's where tolerance starts to set in. It gives you less dopamine, so I need to use more substance, and then I use more substance, and it becomes part of your brain chemistry and in your body physiology. Right, that's why people feel all of it throughout their body when they do try and stop. So the way I try to explain that, an analogy for that would be mental chess. So I am not good at chess, so this is why this is very pertinent for me. It would be as though, right, no matter how good anybody is in this room, do we have any chess masters? No? Yeah. So imagine yourself playing chess against a grandmaster, right? This is kind of what happens to your brain, right? So your brain is developing this, what I would call addict brain. You're starting to play against your own brain. It has your voice, it has your intellect, it has all of your strengths, and it has one thing in mind, and that's use more of the substance. Now, like most of you, like I saw tons of kids here, like I'm busy, right? I'm a father, I'm a husband, I'm a counselor, I'm a friend, I'm a part of a community, I've got errands to run, I've got things to do. My brain is divided in 10 different directions. Addict brain has one direction. And so that's the concept of the chess, is that your brain is constantly maneuvering you, right? And so anybody who's played chess kind of understands, if a grandmaster understands the moves, and it can push you into the places you don't want to be, and you'll find yourself in 10 moves back at a substance you don't want to use, or using a substance that you very much want to use early on in the addiction. So, since I'm not good at chess, the whole idea is I can't play the game, right? I cannot react, I cannot adapt, I cannot use willpower to confront this foe. So part of planning is I play the game in advance, right? I shut down every move from the start. So some of the words that would go with that are triggers, right? So if I have a trigger, right, if my wife is yelling at me, arguing with me, and I wanna then drink, then we have to address that trigger, right? I would then need to work on my relationship with her. We would need to find a new way that if she does yell at me or frustrate me, I need to find a new thing to do too, back to that word cope, right? Maybe I go on a walk. Maybe I do some deep breathing. You know, maybe I call a friend, you know? So we have to start addressing all the avenues that addiction has that gets us back where it wants us. People, places, things, you know, smells, you know, because your neurotransmitters are so linked with, you know, just every aspect of your life, your memories, the smells, oftentimes people will relapse on anniversaries of really bad events, right? They'll be fine and then boom, they are so triggered, they just can't even think straight. You would then say, if you're working with somebody, you're saying, okay, what are your anniversaries ahead? What are the things, events that are coming up that you would need to then like have a plan for? So in a lot of ways, we're just often trying to think about every way you would go about that. For some people, we had to take away their money. You know, for some people, we had to track their location. I mean, it sounds really intense, but in a way, it has to be their motivation or else they'll just, you know, go around it anyway, right? Took a guy's money away and then he started collecting change, right? And he found his way back to alcohol just with a way that nobody saw. But we'll talk a little bit more about how do we play against this grandmaster. But oftentimes when we're thinking like, what in the world is this person doing? Just stop. This is what they're up against. This mentality of I want to stop, but your brain keeps maneuvering you. It keeps trying to get that substance. It keeps trying to get that dopamine release again. I really like this picture. It's a nice picture. The only choice is to choose to treat the disease appropriately. A lot of people feel something about the disease, right? They don't like that. They're just like, ah, this doesn't make sense to me. I don't understand. Isn't it a choice? This is kind of my way of blending the two, right? So my thought is if you choose to treat the disease, let's go to something like diabetes, right? If you don't take your insulin on diabetes, you have consequences, right? It starts to affect your mind, it starts to affect your perception, you start to lose limbs. If you don't treat that disease, you got a problem, right? If you don't treat addiction, you got a problem, and it's not gonna stop, right? It would be like saying, okay, you got a cold, go ahead and will yourself out of it, right? You got cancer, go ahead and will yourself out of it. I mean, we can pray on it, and I believe God does miracles, and I believe God has all the power, but because we also have the medicine that we do and the technology that we do, it is incumbent upon us that we do everything in our power to treat these kind of afflictions. And some people don't like the fact that addiction or mental illness is thrown into that mix. But it very much, and this is something that I've seen for the last decade, it is an undeniable truth that people experience something different than maybe I do or you do. And if we don't consider their perspective, if we don't have empathy, if we don't try and connect with that, if we don't check into all the brain chemistry, then these people might just be lost, right? We'll just get rid of them, right? They're the homeless people out there that we don't want to deal with. So in this picture, I think of it as that crossroads, right? It's the fork in the road, you know? This might be the intervention point. This might be just a time where you're sick of it, right? But to go down the hill, to go where it's easy, to the dark area, to the hidden area, that's tempting, right? It's easier, right? But the reason I like this picture is it's an uphill road. To treat an addiction is incredibly difficult. And anybody who has ever gotten off of a major drug, nicotine, you know, alcohol, any kind of hard drug, they have basically achieved like climbing Mount Everest. Like that's how difficult this can be. So when somebody comes in to meet with somebody like me, or they are forced into groups, you know, psychoeducational groups to learn more about addiction, they would encounter some of these different ways of viewing addiction or treating it. So cognitive behavioral therapy, that's something that I operate in myself. It's a evidence-based practice. That just means it's been done for a long time. They've done plenty of studies, and it is proven to help people, right? Psychology's great. It's a science, just like engineering, just like any, you know, science. And we can make the most of that. It's not more important than the Bible. You know, the Bible is truth, and we'll talk a little bit more about how do we use these things in a way, but at the same time, really make sure that the Bible is primary, that it is possible. Stages of change, this helps us understand what people typically go through. And the fun part about both of these, as we'll talk about, is it applies to all of us in a variety of change situations. and parent, adult, child roles. I'll explain a little bit more. So now I think this is the one that was passed out to everyone. And when I think of cognitive behavioral therapy, I feel like this sums it up in a lot of ways. And what's kind of fun about this is it applies to all areas of life, right? So we would start on the left-hand side, an event, right? So back to my wife yelling at me, right? She's yelling at me, she's nagging me, and that's the event, right? That has the internal, external trigger, like something is happening now. Now, it moves into your automatic thoughts, which I would call automatic thoughts are basically your thought filter, right? So for some people, their wife might yell at them and they might say, you're really angry today. What's going on? How are you doing? Somebody else, they would be like, what's your problem? And they would yell right back, right? There's a reason we do this. And so, expectations, appraisals, attributions, decisions, a lot of this stuff comes down to how are you raised? How are you developed? What did you experience throughout your life? What do you believe about the world? What do you believe about God? What do you believe about relationships? And I don't know, anybody who's seen a filter, it's made up of thousands and thousands of pieces, right? So this is made up of thousands and thousands of thoughts. So a triggering event happens, and you're not even trying. This is just an automatic process, right? It's going through all your stuff, and it filters through and produces an emotion, right? So cognitive behavioral therapy is all about how do I take my mind and my emotions and my actions and behaviors and really understand how they're all linked, right? So this is the flow chart. I love working with engineers because this just really gets them going, just give me something to follow and I'm on it. The emotions, right? So maybe I'm feeling, ashamed. Maybe I'm feeling angry. Maybe I'm feeling depressed. Maybe I'm feeling scared. In a lot of ways, it doesn't matter what the situation is, each person is going to have that unique response to it. So let's say my wife, she's yelling at me and I go through this whole thing. And so an example of automatic thoughts would be, I shouldn't be yelled at. Nobody should be yelled at. That's inappropriate behavior, right? That would be part of my internal thought structure, right? And maybe it's also it's not okay for me to yell back at her. That's intimidating and I shouldn't do that, right? So maybe then produces feelings of powerlessness, right? Now I'm feeling powerless and I don't know what to do. I'm feeling angry, but I don't know how to release it. And then my behavior, right? Behavior choice, it either goes up or down, and adaptive, just fancy word for helpful, right? So either I have a helpful action, which turns on positive or events or turns off negative events, or I have a maladaptive action, which turns off negative events or experiences. So no matter how I react, if I yell, if I say nothing at all, some people might say that's a good thing. But in a lot of ways, saying nothing at all is a problem because if I feel something and it's intense, and I keep storing that up, I build resentment, and it starts to create a bigger problem. So whether I yell, whether I do that, we would call that a bad or negative or bad outcome. So behavior weakened, yet thoughts are maybe strengthened. And it's the thoughts that produced it, right? And so what happens is that just wraps around and creates those automatic thoughts again. So that's just kind of your typical. Let's go to drugs. Right? So if she yells at me, I have the automatic thought of, I have drank alcohol before and it made me feel a lot better when somebody was yelling at me. Well, now I drank that alcohol and now my emotions might be peaceful, might be tolerant, maybe patient. Maybe I can endure, this situation. The behavior, action would be, okay, I'm going to drink alcohol because that's what has worked for me so many times before. Well, that would be the maladaptive action. Now, the negative events come along with alcohol, right? I think that, to quote Homer Simpson, alcohol is the cause of and the solution to all of life's little problems, right? The problem is you might solve that moment, but you've created a different problem, right? And so, as we go through this, this might be another one, right? So my event is I need to get home from the bar and I'm drunk. And I've gotten home hundreds of times drunk, so why wouldn't I do that again? Right now, my feeling is I'm invincible. I'm nothing can stop that, right? I'm confident. I choose to do that, and they would think I got home safe, so that's good, right? No, wrong. So what would happen is they would do that on average back in the day when I was doing this, the number was 70 times. So they would say, you know, your average person with a DUI had done this 70 times before being caught. When I talked about this in the groups, they laughed at me. They're like, hundreds, dude. We've done this hundreds of times. And I think in a lot of ways, they, you know, it didn't start that way. Some people would even say, you know what, I'm a better driver when I'm drunk. You know, and they were just dead serious, right? Now, what was interesting is they're probably more intentional, right? They probably speed when they're sober, and they probably drive the speed limit when they're drunk, so they think that's better. But what happens is they get home, and they get a little bolder, and now they're driving a little faster. Before long, they're driving home at 90 miles an hour because they, in their brain, think that they're invincible, right? So we would say we need to create more adaptive action. So if the event is you are triggered, somebody's yelling at you, we would need to say, choose better, right? Choose better sounds like willpower, right? Just do better. Don't do that. Do something else. But we're taking out the brain chemistry stuff. We're taking out the automatic thoughts. In a lot of ways, this is an automatic process. You might say, hey, well, don't feel so bad about it, right? I mean, you know, she's yelling at you. Who cares, right? You can't tell somebody how to feel. That's kind of one of our trump cards in therapy, right? If I say I feel, right, that's my perception, right? That doesn't mean it's true. Feelings aren't facts, but that is the reality to me, right? So if I'm saying I feel really hurt by that, it doesn't really matter what the other person, you know, was intending in a lot of ways. Like, that's my perception, and I will react out of that. So in a lot of ways, we're trying to say, okay, well, just don't feel bad, right? Just feel better. Don't feel so anxious, right? That doesn't work. So in a lot of ways, we would say we must go back to the automatic thoughts. We have to identify the thoughts that lead to your emotions and your eventual choice. So we might say, okay, so if I say that, you know, alcohol is just, it's the cure-all, and when I drink it, everything's better. Maybe we add in the automatic thought of, you know what, alcohol actually produced a lot of problems in my life. It's ruining my marriage, it put me in this DUI situation, and I feel terrible. And so we would try and build that out, right? And we're trying to build their filter, take out the bad stuff that's producing the bad, you know, the more maladaptive action, put in more of the good stuff. And this is all client motivated, right? These are all their true thoughts. So I can't implant them or incept them into them, right? They have to start working through their own issues and really changing these things over on their own. So there's lots more we can do with this. I use this for clients who don't have addiction problems. I use this for couples. It's really cool to think about, why do I do what I do? And often go back to the attitudes, values, and beliefs, right? So if I believe in Jesus Christ and I believe he told me to love my enemies, I can't hate that person, right? You know, Matthew 5, like, you know, if I hate a person, it's like killing them, right? Like, this is a problem, and I can't just indulge that anymore, right? So I must find a new way to do that. So I would go into my automatic thoughts, and I would really address those things so that my actions fit with my, you know, core values. And you're in discord without it. Positive outlook, that's another one. Just the science of positivity and thankfulness is out there. It's true. I mean, you have a positive outlook, better things happen. People like you better, right? Like, doesn't mean that never be negative or real, but if you choose to be positive, if you kind of address the areas of your life and why you're so negative, sometimes that can really rewire some things. Okay, I love stages of change. I think it's a really cool tool. I mean, everybody, think of a change in your life that you would like to execute on going forward, right? My perpetual change is I want to go to the gym and I want to exercise, but alas, I'm a father and I have dad bod. I'm shaped like a pear, and that is what it is for now, right? So we'll use that example briefly, right? So pre-contemplation, there was a time where I wasn't aware that the weight was coming on and I was slowing down and I was losing, you know, my stamina. That's pre-contemplation. I'm unaware of the problem. Contemplation, I'm aware of the problem and of the desired behavioral change. So when I say my wife's yelling at me, she's the wonderful, most sweetest woman in the world. She doesn't even yell, period. But she did point this out, right? I can thank her for pointing out that I was getting a little doughy. She made me aware of the problem and of the desired behavior change. She's a health nut. She's a, yeah, it's a lot. So when I really want to get this party started, when I really want to start exercising, I'm going to have to develop that internal motivation, right? She can ask me to, she can want me to, all she wants. If I don't want to, no change plan I create or anybody else creates is going to work until I'm ready to do it. So let's reset with addiction. So now we'll go back to alcohol consumption, right? So somebody will say, I'm more fun when I drink, right? I'm the life of the party. I'm cool. It's all good. I'm more calm. And other people are like, no, you're actually a jerk. Like, you say really horrible things and you are embarrassing me, right? So maybe that's, they get some feedback. Maybe they get a DUI. Maybe they hurt themselves. Maybe they start to develop, you know, some kind of disorder as a result of it. Something usually happens to intervene. It's rare that somebody just wakes up one day and is like, I've got a drug problem. I should probably work on that, right? There has to be some kind of thing that happens to them that is negative enough or gets their attention. Contemplation, now I'm aware of the problem, but we have the problem of ambivalence, which is if the fancy word we use from basically I want two things, right? I want to go to the gym and I want to lay down for a bit, right? I want those two things equal, and that's what causes me not to move, right? In this, most people in their change process, whatever you're thinking about changing, most of the time we get stuck in contemplation. You know what you want to do, you know why you want to do it, but you can't make yourself do it, right? This is a bigger problem for addiction because now it's not just a behavioral issue, it is also a substance issue. It's a brain chemistry issue if we are to adopt the disease model. So oftentimes when somebody's in contemplation, they are, you know, let's use heroin, for example. The withdrawals for heroin are so insanely painful that I've talked to people and they are just crying. They are just in anguish over the fact that they don't want to use, but they know that they probably will because they're in so much pain and there's only one thing that's going to cure that. Their brain's calling out for it. And if they go get it, everything's better. In fact, you know, and this is, you know, kind of science has proven this, and I've heard this from countless people. It's like they start to get the brain release when they're on the way to pick up the substance. Like, that's how much the brain is anticipating this thing, right? It wants it, and it will make it happen, and it will actually reward you for even going down the road to it, right? That's the checkmate aspect of the grandmaster addict brain. So let's say somebody does, right? So let's say they'd hit rock bottom or say that they're involved in the criminal justice system or their wife's threatening to leave them, and whether they like it or not, it's time to change. Preparation would be, whether it's internal or external, that's now time to create a plan, right? So in creating a plan, they would address all those things. What are your coping strategies? What are your triggers? Who do you need to avoid? Where do you need to avoid? And I mean, it gets insanely complicated, even down to like the level of creating your support system has to be this plurality of different people that you can call at a moment's notice. And it's a very involved process, but that's how serious we are about this. Action would be just playing out that plan, right? Maintenance would be, I have done the plan for, you know, according to the diagnostic manual, be about 90 days for remission from a substance, and it would be a year for full remission, right? Partial remission, 90 days, full remission, a year. And we would probably say maintenance happens around a year, right? That means I've done my plan so long, it's now my lifestyle. Now there's a sixth stage to the stages of change that nobody likes, and it's relapse. If anybody's ever tried to change something in their life, whether it's going to the gym or changing like a massive drug habit, it's rare that they get it right the first time. Now, if perfection is my mentality, which it often is for people, they will fail with that first use, and then they're going to say, well, screw it. I'm just going to do it over and over again, right? It's already over. I'm a failure, right? And that might be one of their unique triggers. And so what we would say, and this is what people don't like, but we would say it is likely you will fall. So we will even plan for falls. We're saying try your absolute hardest not to, but if you fall, this is what you will do. Right? And so the people who I've seen get the most kind of direct and long-lasting change will create a great plan, try their hardest to do it, something will trigger them, some reason. We would call it a lapse, like a one-time use kind of thing, like I just drank, you know, all night, and now I got to get back on my plan, right? If they confess, if they talk about what's going on and they get back on their plan, then we would go back down to preparation. Let's make a better plan, right? Let's get your accountability people involved and let's make a better plan. They try it again, and you might do a few laps there, right? But if you do a few laps, your plan's getting better and better. Your brain's getting cleaner and cleaner. And by the time you get that 90 days sobriety and that year sobriety, you may have learned a ton through your mistakes, which we don't want to, but that's part of life, right? So this is great. So whatever change you're thinking of, you could look up stages of change, right? A lot of this is very Googleable, right? You could go to YouTube and type in effects of the brain on addiction, and you will get a much better explanation than I gave, and animation, and all kinds of stuff. Like, it's incredible. So the addiction knowledge is out there. Oftentimes, we're not thinking of it. I'll try and run through this kind of quick. So parent, adult, child roles, we would say these are two people. These are roles that are played in a relationship. Right, so I'm a parent, my child, I don't trust them, so I control them to protect them, not in an authoritarian, but in a loving, gentle way. And they have to relate to me as a parent and an authority, right? So I want them to become an adult one day, which would be independent, responsible, accountable for their actions. And as a parent, ideally, I will move down into an adult role as well once they're independent of me. And I will show them respect. I will show them trust. And even if they want to get some face tattoo or something, I can say, I don't think that's a great idea, but all right, you know. And it's hard because I can't forbid it at that point, right? So we'll just pray. I mean, this applies to a lot of different things, right? You may not like your child's spouse, or you may not like their career choice or whatever. And if you try and control them, you will have a bad relationship with them. I'm sure some of you have those relationships with your parents currently. Part of that is we need to get to that adult to adult role. This is kind of fun I do a lot of marriage counseling, and it's fun to examine your marriage on this level, because a lot of times we have a very parent-child relationship thing going. That's not good. You gotta work on that. But when it comes to addiction, you can kind of see how this might happen. So if this is an addicted couple, or in a double couple with somebody who's addicted to drugs, you know, maybe the spouse is in the parent role saying, like, you gotta stop, I'm gonna control you, I'm gonna control every aspect of your life, right? That puts the other person in that child role, which is oftentimes categorized by hiding, avoiding, lying, rebelling. Just like your kids might do, and if they're getting reprimanded a little bit, right? It's because they're acting powerless in a lot of ways, right? So my child might go get a whole bag of gummy bears because if he asked me, I'd say no. So he'll just go do it, right? And ask forgiveness later, maybe. When it's addiction, you can create this dynamic in a relationship, and it's actually this dynamic actually drives the person who's in the addiction deeper into it. Because they feel ashamed, they feel guilty, they feel inadequate, they feel just like an embarrassment, and they don't like being treated like a child, but so they act more like a child. And we do this, I do this sometimes, and I won't go into that, but this happens to all of us in a way, right? So these roles can shift and change, but with addiction, it's pretty much a permanent parent-child role. And that doesn't have to be a marriage, it could be just you with your friend, or you with a family member. So how to help loved ones in the community with addiction problems? This is not an exhaustive list, but hopefully you have a better understanding of what we're after here, right? So acknowledge powerlessness over their addiction. Is that, you know, that's the 12-step, step one. In a way, we kind of have to start to maybe empathize with that. Do you have any area of your life where you're not changing despite knowing you need to do it? Have you ever felt powerless before, right? If maybe these people feel profoundly powerless and they just need somebody to come alongside them, right? And sometimes that we can't be those people if we're judging their action. Like, of course it's wrong. We all know that drugs are destroying, you know, the world. We know this. But these people are so locked up in it that that doesn't matter to them. So as we acknowledge our own powerlessness, we would understand theirs. Boundaries, There's a great book by Cloud and Townsend. It's called Boundaries. It's the kind of the go-to book for understanding in what ways do I need to navigate relationships in a way that shows respect to me, but also shows respect to them. Oftentimes, this is probably one of the bigger issues with somebody who's enabling an addict, right? So even in that parent-child role, the person in the parent role, they might be trying to stop them, but they're also maybe, you know, hiding things for them, or they're calling work, right? So, oh, my husband can't come in, he's sick today. No, he's drunk and hungover, right? But you're going to kind of help him out with that as you think you're protecting him. You're really not. So this is a much, I mean, I could do a whole talk on boundaries alone. Al-Anon, if you know somebody who has an addiction, if it's somebody in your family, if it's somebody close to you, going to an Al-Anon group is basically AA for the people that are in the life of the person who's struggling. So it would be a peer support in that they would tell stories, they would give you education, boundary education for sure, on how to navigate those relationships. So there are Al-Anon groups everywhere. They are fantastic and couldn't, you know, recommend them more strongly. Lovingly encouraging them to seek appropriate level of treatment, that's very difficult because they might say, no, I don't want to, or I don't care. And this is the concept of you are powerless over their addiction, right? If you embrace that idea, you can suggest, you know, a lot of times parents of an addicted, you know, child, they might say, hey, I'm not going to let you stay at my house. I'm not going to pay for your, you know, you're going to be homeless, but I'll pay for you to go to addiction treatment, right? An inpatient facility. So that might be just their standard. That's their boundary that they create. Acknowledge our own powerlessness over sin or actions contrary to core values. Oh, I apologize. I'm way over an hour. Sorry, too much. There's so much content I even left out. It's just too much. This is obviously the most important part, right? So would anybody here disagree that you are profoundly addicted to sin? Did anybody sin today? I did on the way here, you know? The concept of sin is that if we want to connect with people who are struggling with this powerlessness, we must acknowledge our own powerlessness. So I love the entire Bible. I think it's the entire story is amazing start to finish, and it's got everything you need in it. So this is going back to basically, you know, just after creation, the Lord said to Cain, right? Adam and Eve, you know, they fall, sin enters the world, they have Cain and Abel. The Lord says, Cain, why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, you will not be will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must rule over it. The Hebrew words for this are pretty intense, right? The concept of sin wants to have you. It wants to inhabit you. It wants to control you. Anybody who's suffered with an addiction, they understand that. They understand that on a deeper level. That's why I love working with addiction, because they understand their own powerlessness over sin in a way that a sober person never could. Because we think we've got it, right? I mean, I sinned on the way here, but I was just a little blip. I think I can get it right now. If I don't accept that powerlessness, sin is ever waiting, and basically it's the deception component, right? If I am deceived and I think I'm okay, then I'm more lost than I could imagine. I don't think I need to go down the addiction or drunkenness condemned in the Bible thing, right? I mean, it's throughout, right? I think some of the scarier things in this would be, you know, down in Galatians 5, you know, envy, drunkenness, orgies, things like these. I warn you, as I warned you before, that those who do such things will not inherit the kingdom of God. There may be greater stakes in all of this. And we're not saying anybody who drinks alcohol is going to hell. You know, we're not going there. I'm not getting extreme on you. But what if you stay in it? What if you don't get out of it, right? And that's not just the only sin, right? If you gossip with regularity, I'm not saying that you're going to not go into the kingdom of heaven, but what if? What if that is something that is driving you further and further away from God? It's a sin. Doesn't matter if it's socially acceptable or not. sexual sin. This is the most insidious form of all, because it is much easier to hide it. I do want to touch on Ephesians 5, right? So do not get drunk with wine, for that is debauchery, but be filled with the Spirit. This is a really interesting thing. So, church in Ephesus, Paul's writing a letter to this church, and sometimes getting the backdrop of it's really helpful. So, Greek mythology, right? So we've got Zeus, and it's a very weird story on how he, eventually births Dionysius, so I won't get into. But Dionysius is, effectively the god, he is ruling the earth, right? And so the worship of Dionysius, and it's really cool. You can check archaeology, you check all these ancient, historical records. You can see these old temples. The worship of Dionysius was alcohol consumption and sexual perversion. So drunken orgies, right, were basically the way you would worship. And if you look at different, temples, they would have prostitutes there, and that's how they would make their money. And people would go and worship by committing these sexual acts, or by drinking so much they would enter the, ecstasy, enthusiasms of, just kind of being out of your mind. And that was worship for them, right? And they would even have, holes in the ground for them to vomit so they could drink more wine, right? This was pervasive. This was throughout the, Greek and Roman Empire. So this is who Paul's effectively talking to, right? And so when he talks about don't get drunk with wine, but be filled with the Holy Spirit, that concept of being filled with wine, to be filled with addiction, to be filled with sin, to allow it to control you, to take your control away. Well, how do you deal with that? Fill yourself with the Holy Spirit. And it goes on with songs and hymns and spiritual songs, worship. Get in with your community. Submit to one another. Accountability. I mean, the Bible is full of all of the ways to avoid addiction, avoid sexual sin, especially that pervasive, consistent lifestyle of it that may or may not affect your eternal destiny. Sexual immorality, flee sexual immorality, right? I would tell clients, there's one way you can definitely, avoid a trigger. If somebody's offering you drugs or if somebody's propositioning you, if you run a mile in the other direction, you will definitely avoid the encounter, right? Flee, run, whatever it takes. That's the concept of play the game. Don't let your brain maneuver you. Don't get it yourself in a position that you can't get out of. Our bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit, right? But the sexually immoral person sins against their own body, right? Put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you, sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. So even this concept of, idolatry, right? I don't know about any of you if you've ever seen anybody worship an idol firsthand. I have not. But one of the things we would submit within this is we are the idols. Right? Go back to your, social media. Come before the altar of me. Give me likes. Tell me how good I am. Right? There is some pervasive, sinful, addictive things within very, very tame behaviors that you would never have that intention for. But if I'm hurting, I'm going to dedicate alcohol to the idol of Michael, and I will feel better because I am all important. Right? So the Bible is filled with, we are not God. We are not to be idolized. We are not to be served. In so many ways, we really have to work through these things with our community by knowing the scriptures, right? The answers are all in there. Anybody who, has read the Bible, they know this. We know this. But do we go back to it? Do we encourage people to go to it? We are slaves to sin. Do you not know that if you present yourselves to anyone as obedient slaves, you are slaves of the one whom you obey? People obey the substance. People obey the idol of self. People obey money. People obey lots of things that are not God, either in sin, which leads to death, or of obedience, which leads to righteousness. But thanks be to God that you who were once slaves to sin have become obedient from the heart to the standard of teaching to which you were committed, and having been set free from sin, have become slaves of righteousness. concept of being a slave to Jesus is not super important to a lot of people. Just the term doesn't really resonate with you, but it's very much a part of the New Testament. Slave language is 100% throughout. And the concept of us as Americans being slaves, I know is a tough sell, but to embrace that idea of either you're a slave to Christ or you are a slave to sin, you are a slave to yourself, and we know where that leads. Jesus answered them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin." And I know I've gone way over, so I do want to save some time for questions. These are just some of the resources. Questions? Sorry, if somebody has a question, you can just shout it out while some are coming up. We can. I think that, you know, some of those mental health disorders do come, the onset is around that time period. And oftentimes kids are using long before that. And so I don't know of a direct correlation myself, but I know that oftentimes that it can be very much a part of it. And in a lot of ways, maybe the addiction's been there for a long time and it was the biological kind of natural course. But yeah, it's definitely a very concerning thing, because once kids leave the home and they're experimenting with a variety of drugs, that can definitely become really problematic and be onset for some pretty serious mental health disorders. All right. When is depravity and sin the consideration and need to be addressed, as opposed to treating addictions in correspondence to a supposed brain path? Doesn't that limit hope? So I don't know if that got answered later, but when is depravity and sin a consideration? It's kind of, that's the acceptance piece, right? We are all profoundly sinful, right? So if we can all accept that we are slaves to sin, then we would look at what is it you're struggling with, right? So if it's sexual sin, we'll just say like pornography, for instance, right? So we would say, what things do we need to do to put in place to address this particular sin issue, right? You have a choice to do it. We're not ever excusing, you know, look at more pornography. Oh, use, it's okay. You're addicted. That's not the case, right? It's still sin. And we don't want people to persist in sin. So we would then say, play the chess game out ahead of time, right? Help them work their lives, right? Change their lifestyle, you know, become slaves to, you know, the Lord and just whip their body into shape and discipline themselves to that, right? We're not discounting the disease, but we are saying that you do need to discipline yourself. You do need to choose to treat the addiction. Does that limit hope? Whose question was that? Oh, no, you get two questions. There you go. So I don't know. And what do you mean, does that limit hope? No, good question. I think a lot of times explaining the brain path thing is helping them understand what they're up against. And in a lot of ways, once they start to understand the chemical nature of things, they actually do gain hope of change. Just like if somebody, you know, is suffering from, you know, depression, right? So, you know, somebody who's suffering from depression, we all have our ups and downs, but what happens with that? They start to have these progressively lower and lower ups and downs, and they don't necessarily know they're depressed, they just know they feel low and terrible all the time, but it's like normal to them. So you would come along and say, okay, well, here are your symptoms, here's your diagnosis, here's how we're gonna treat this disease, and oftentimes it gives them a great sense of hope and actually relief to say, like, I'm not crazy. You know, I'm not profoundly lost. I'm not powerless. Sometimes people just need to kind of have a path, right, presented to them. And oftentimes that'll get the ball rolling. All right. We don't need alcohol, sex, pornography, gambling to survive. We do need food. Shouldn't food be an entirely different category of addictions? We cannot deny ourselves food, unlike other addictions that we're overcoming. That is an interesting one, right? So with food, we would say it's an overconsumption of food that is problematic, right? That if you are gaining weight and it's causing other health issues, if you're, losing, your stamina. So we would just say, just like any kind of behavior, right? I wish the Bible, I'm a big rules guy. I wish the Bible condemned all the bad stuff, right? It says, don't ever gamble, don't ever drink alcohol, just don't do it. But it doesn't do that, right? And so it's this concept of alcohol, in different parts, Proverbs 31, right? So this is, advice to a king, and it's saying, don't drink alcohol as a ruler, as a leader, but you can give that to the people that are dying and the people who are kind of basically lost and downtrodden, right? It's not saying do it, right? But it's kind of saying those are the people, right? Alcohol is for the dying. Alcohol at that time period was a depressant. It was an opiate. It was a painkiller, not an opiate, but it helped numb the pain, right? Paul tells Timothy, have some wine for your stomach, right? My wife's really into stomach health, and that's like a whole thing. And she makes me take these, can't even remember what they're called, but I just take them, and it's all about gut health. And so these are things that I wish that it just wasn't in there, because that complicates things in so many ways. But in a way, we were saying that like food is great. Food is fantastic. Food releases dopamine, but the overconsumption, right? Which some people, right, if you look in the ancient world, people who were overweight were actually the wealthy ones. They were the ones who were probably better off than anybody else. So being stick thin and like that back in those days meant you were about to die, or you were a slave, or like on your own. So it's not saying that we need to all be super skinny and do that, but it is saying like you need to figure out what is your point for consumption that is healthy for you. Does counselee? Something of confidentiality impede church body discipleship opportunities, impede transparency with the body of believers? Great question. I like this one. Now, a lot of people come talk to me, and it's the confidentiality that draws them in, right? They want to talk to somebody who's not going to repeat anything that they're saying. Now, the bounds of confidentiality, harm to self, harm to others, child abuse, elder abuse, terrorism. If anybody's talking about any of those things, I would need to intervene, right, on some level. If you're not talking about those things, then yes, confidentiality does exist. And if I'm the only person you're talking to about this thing, I personally feel that the body of Christ is meant to be such a body that would draw people in, right? That would allow them to heal within that, where they would have accountability, they would have love, they would have compassion, but they would also have somebody actually confronting what's happening, right? So in a lot of cases, like, I'm not a pastor, but people will come and talk to me when they won't go and talk to their pastors. And I encourage them to go talk to their pastors. I encourage them to get involved in a peer group. I encourage them to get involved in their church community, because it can't stop with me. It can start there though, right? I might be the first person they ever utter these words to in their life. And without that confidentiality, they may not have ever said it to anyone. And it's really cool in the brain, like, where if I'm thinking about something, I can't really do much with it, right? I might get stuck. But if I tell somebody, right, tell my friend, hey, this is what I'm struggling with, right? I might be drinking more than I thought, or I might be having impure thoughts, or I might be doing this or that, right? So if I say that to somebody else, I hear myself say it, so I start processing it differently. And then they react, right? Their facial reaction, they might be like, oh my gosh, like, that's terrible, or they might say, oh my gosh, that's so, I'm so sorry. They hear me, they then react to it, and that's more input for my brain. So now my brain's processing this one idea in so many other ways, right? So ideally, it starts with counseling, and ideally, it grows out, because I don't want them to meet with me forever. It's a very odd job. You develop the close relationship, and just when things are getting good, they leave, right? That's great. That's what it's supposed to be. But they must be resourced. And if they are leaving, not talking to anybody else, that's not sustainable. And that I definitely don't ever want to hinder discipleship or engagement in their community. Do you see a correlation between older teen, early college addiction? Oh, that was a good question, too. When does someone need to detox before they try anything else? Great question. So, it depends. So it depends on how far the alcohol use or the drug use has persisted. So, for instance, when I was in the detox facility, there's a disease disorder called delirium tremens, or the DTs, that people will get when they have consumed alcohol in great excess for too long. They will start hallucinating. They will start losing their grip on reality. They will not be able to care for themselves. And that would be as scary and awful as it gets. And unfortunately, a lot of times homeless people who are addicted to substances, not all homeless people are addicted to substances, but the ones who are have often kind of reached that point where they're no longer willing to take help. They're not really kind of in control anymore. And those are often the people that would get brought into the detox facility, and there's nothing we can do for them aside from just keep them safe, right? When it comes to like a heroin addiction, that's a real problem, because if you leave somebody who is trying to get off heroin alone, they will probably, once they start experiencing the pain and the nausea and everything starts crashing in, they will get out and they will go find whatever they can to keep it going, right? So even like an opiate addiction, so say you have a surgery and you take opiates for your pain, but then that, you know, you're taking your pain meds the doctor gave you. Well, the whole brain chemistry thing's kicking right there. And you might develop a dependence on heroin or an opiate, sorry, not heroin, an opiate that then down the road you want more. So now you're buying pills, you're doctor shopping, right? You're going around looking for more, and they're way more expensive. Well, heroin's very cheap in comparison. And so people who end up on heroin are not like people who are necessarily looking to get there, but they oftentimes were in so much pain that they just would do anything to get that thing that would stop the pain. And in a lot of ways, I feel like, you know, we as humans do that, right? And instead of like, if I've got a headache, instead of, you know, maybe relaxing, you know, taking some downtime, I'm gonna take some, pop some, you know, Advils and just keep on going, right? We push past these things, but we take things for it. But this is just on a whole different level, right? The need is just beyond anything we can imagine. What does replacing negative automatic thoughts look like in real time, especially with addictions? I don't know, who asked this one? But what would be an example that you're looking for?
Like, if you're working with someone on this chart, you know, so the company thinks whatever's going on, like, this is sort of an automatic thought.
Mm-hmm. So in talk therapy, you know, people are like, well, how are you going to fix anything with just talking, right? It's incredible, right? If you listen to people, they will tell you what the problem is. We are inherently bad listeners. And I'll be the first to admit I was a horrible listener prior to grad school, right? We literally had to, you know, go through whole things where we would ask questions and like listen and ask a question, and we would record ourselves, and then we would have to then come up with like five other responses that we could have to it. And we would just do this over and over and over again because we are inherently bad listeners, right? I'm often thinking about, what do I want to say to this person? How do I want to reply with my opinion, right? Or I might just jump right in and try and solve their problem, right? So in a lot of ways, we don't listen to people. They don't ever get the problem out, right? So in a lot of ways, I am a professional listener, right? I create an environment for clients to come in and share everything, share stuff they've never shared before, just get it all out on the table. And it's incredible, right? Another theory I work with is person-centered therapy, which sounds very, you know, very modern. And it's just saying, I respect people enough to say, I'm not the expert, you're gonna solve your problem, I'm just going to be along for the ride, I'm gonna facilitate the process, I'm just gonna create a safe space for you to talk, right? This is not a therapist thing. Anybody can do this. Like, any human can sit and listen to a person and be a safe person and not just jump right out in judgment. You might want to get the whole story first, right? We don't like this concept of judgment. Sounds like a really bad word. Judgment's just saying, is something good or bad, right? If you are living in sin, that's bad. They know it. You know it. Maybe figure out why, right? So they might talk about the automatic thoughts that lead to that. that use. So let's use sexual, you know, addiction or just pornography, right? So they might say, you know, it's like, well, you know, I saw a billboard once, you know, it's cheaper than dating. You know, it was like a pornography store. It's like, what an awful message. You know, that would be an, that would right there be an automatic thought, right? It's like, well, you know, I can't find, you know, a woman to be with, or I don't have the money for this or that, and I like that, but I know it's a sin. And so we would examine as many of those thoughts that kind of lead to that eventuality of engaging in porn use. And oftentimes, I mean, you could still engage in the porn use and you would feel profound shame the whole time, right? I've talked to guys who have, just like the, you know, heroin addicts, they have been in tears. They're like, why do I keep looking at this? Like, why does this happen? Why do I don't want this? I hate it. I feel terrible. I feel like a robot as I do this thing. And I don't say it's okay. I don't say that, right? Say, yeah, I hear you. I hear that you are in profound amounts of pain and you're doing something that you don't want to do. Yeah, that's probably one of my, I don't know if I talked about that verse. Oh, what? There we go. Yeah. So this is one of those kind of classic, you know, sin addiction verses, right? So for I know that nothing good dwells in me, that is in my flesh, for I have a desire to do what is right, but not the ability to carry it out. For I do not do the good I want, but the evil I do not want is what I keep doing. Now if I do what I do not want, it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. So if I find it to be a law that when I want to do right, evil lies close at hand, for I delight in the law of God in my inner being, but I see in my members another law waging war against the law of my mind and making me captive to the law of sin that dwells in my members. Wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? Thanks be to God through Jesus Christ our Lord. So then I myself serve the law of God with my mind, but with my flesh I serve the law of sin. And we can, with our minds, choose to confront these issues. We can choose to create plans that shut us off from the sinful behavior that is destroying us. Progressively, we know it. We want to stop. Sometimes you need a little help, right? And trust me, if I have a dream one day that I'm put out of business and I got to go find something else to do, right? If communities took care of people, and this is why I feel so excited about the leadership of Solo Church and the people here tonight, I feel very passionate about communities caring for these people. But we need to be better listeners. We need to lovingly encourage them to get the help they need, but be there with them, right? So we can't control that, but you can encourage them. You can love on them. And maybe with a little bit more empathy, that might be easier. I don't know, any other questions?
This might be too cold, but I guess I was just wondering in your experience, the first part is there a certain time period that someone has an addiction, I think, where they typically will never succeed in getting out of it, or I guess maybe this is just dependent on the situation, but what have you seen as have been some of the most successful, like, people that have been able to, let's just say, conquer their addictions and get out of that addiction? Does it depend on things that depend on their life environment, the community? I don't know. But I guess I'm just thinking specifically of, like, numerous people that we know, whether it's been 10 years or maybe a lifetime, maybe it's been 15, 20. Like, sometimes I think there's a part of me that just, it does feel very hopeless. Like,
That's a fantastic question. And I don't know if there's a definitive answer on it, but I myself personally have worked with people who have been, you know, 40 years in addiction and came out. Not because of me. That was not my doing. It was their motivation. It was their desire. And we just created the structure to help them get there. But oftentimes some people will enable something that goes on that long. I actually, when I was in grad school, I was valeting cars downtown, and I remember Christmas Eve. I had a lot of interactions with the homeless down there, and it was very educational in a lot of ways. And you know, it was snowing, it was awful, and you know, this homeless man comes to the stand, and we just were talking about you know his situation, and he's saying, you know, I just drank a pint, and I can't get into the homeless shelter because I've done this thing, right? I mean, he's now out in the snow. There's nothing, unless somebody like takes him in, and that's, you know, that there's not a lot of people doing that. You know, he is out there, and a lot of times people can't access the shelters and the programs they need because they're intoxicated, because they're high, and they can't stop doing it, right? And I think, you know, it's a wonderful idea to like take in, you know, somebody like a homeless person and try to like love on them and do that, but that's where the boundaries come in. And that's why, you know, we give money to homeless shelters and we give money to homeless programs that help people because they can do it more effectively than I can as a person. You know, with all the you know skills I have, like often change that you're talking about could take 3, 4, 5 years because that's how profoundly addicted they are. I'll often use the, it would have been a good slide, but I'll use the analogy. Has anybody been to Las Vegas before? A few people. You know, I'll often, you know, the lights, everybody's kind of seen the pictures, right? I think of the strip, that's like your neural pathway on drugs, right? It's way overwhelming. It's super easy to go down. It's very enticing. And in a way, what we're trying to do is we're saying, okay, we gotta get a new neural pathway, right? So we gotta close down the strip, right? So we put a roadblock, we get a little road around, and we start working this road, right? And the more you do this thing, the easier it gets. But Las Vegas doesn't go away. The strip's still there. The lights just turn off. And that's why you might have the person who's like, I've done this 40 years. They're totally motivated. They do that. And then they slip up, and they have their lapse. Well, now a casino turns back on. And then that makes it easier to go back again and again. And you can light the whole thing back up again, even after you've shut it down. And so the neural pathway never goes away. So it does feel hopeless at times, but that's where really working that end around really works.
I guess I was just thinking, especially somebody who's been in jail, and then they get out on probation, and a lot of times the rules of probation actually prevent them from like writing a danger zone. You know, like the places that restrict it to, a lot of that.
Yeah, people will often say, thank God I got sent to jail, you know, because that'll shut down your strip. You know, there's drugs in there and you can get substances, but usually that removal will help. But when I was doing drug court, actually we were, you know, we had a little center on Colfax and Federal, and anybody who's been down there, it's pretty much like drugs just walking around, you know, like for the picking at that point. And people would say exactly that. They're like, why are you located here? Like, this is like too tempting in a way. And part of it was what we needed to be in an area that they could access through, you know, public transportation and different things. And so, yes, it is very much a difficult situation. But, you know, programs like that, though they have to talk about it, though they are put in that position, it's the best, I think, that we've come up with so far. But oftentimes, you know, families are pretty much done with people by that point. And so I think, yeah, it's that last ditch effort, and it's really hard. So we would kind of see that as more the attitudes, values, and beliefs section. And so a lot of times, and you know, anytime you're talking to somebody, I've found that you know people have been in the church their entire lives and they know very little Bible, right? They know very little Jesus. It's really cool that the people who are willing to use the text in session, we'll pull it out and we'll read it, right? And we'll get them into, you know, reading about Jesus, and we'll get them into different passages that start to develop some of that understanding, you know, develop some of that internal motivation to engage the text on their own, but also to say, hey, let's develop let's get you going on developing your values and your beliefs. Because oftentimes people, you know, they might be a believer, but maybe they haven't read a lot of scripture. Maybe they might have some squirrely beliefs. And sometimes we just have to examine those and we, you know, run it up against the text. Does that make sense? Sure. Well, a good example would be somebody's, you know, doing that maladaptive action of going back to pornography over and over again, right? If I'm talking to somebody of the world, right? So like 1 Corinthians, you know, 5 near the end, it's talking about like, how do we judge people from the world because they don't share our core values, right? We're to judge those inside the church who do share our core values, right? And there is this concept of judge is right or wrong, right? So looking at pornography, according to Jesus, even thinking about a woman, you know, sexually is adultery, right? So we would start to build out that kind of an understanding. And we would say, for the believer, right, you need to develop that core value that is adultery. You do not want to be an adulterer. And we would go down that road and try and reinforce that. And if that's strong enough, maybe that starts to change some of the things down the road. For somebody of the world, it does often become very man-centered and me-centered. And it's I feel like it's insufficient to really get at the root of the problem. But psychology does provide them some level of hope and change and positivity. But it always leaves a little bit still left on the table. Yeah.
Where do you start? Because you attack one, and the other ones pull them right back down, and it's...
You know, that's a kind of harm reduction mentality. If you were oftentimes, like when we were in the, you know, more of the legal setting, we would attack the legal substance first. And we would say, okay, you probably, like, smoking cigarettes is still working on your mind, right? That's still working your dopamine pretty hard. So I don't want that. That's not good. And it's still keeping your brain chemistry in that addicted state. But oftentimes, it's kind of like taking them, you know, one or two at a time, but choosing the more intense ones. So here's one thing we didn't use. All right, so we'll say this stand here is like the range of pleasure that you can understand or experience naturally. So sex is at the top, your favorite meals, your exhilarations, all this. When you're on meth, right? Like if we're just looking for like a straight comparison, just go like 1,000 feet up, right? Way above this building. Like that's how much dopamine meth releases in comparison to sex and everything else. So it rewires your brain in a way to where you don't experience pleasure down here anymore. You got to be way up in the clouds to get that pleasure. So then people are coming off this stuff and they're saying, well, sex doesn't feel good anymore. My favorite meal doesn't taste good anymore. Like, what is this? Like, it often takes about 90 days for that dopamine level in your brain chemistry to come back down. So in that person who's, you know, multi-addicted, so cocaine and heroin and even nicotine, you know, can be way up there, right? All those, you know, you would say, okay, which one's illegal, which one's causing the most harm, and how do we attack it progressively? But ultimately, if I had my druthers, I'd get them all, you know, at once. But to watch people go through it, it just doesn't work that way for them. Good question, though. Yeah. Yeah. Oh man, that's a great question. It's interesting, like at the beginning of your career, you're very much hooked into their success, right? So the person, oh man, they're sober, their life's getting better. I mean, honestly, like early on it was, I was on a roller coaster with them, right? They're like, oh, I relapsed and my wife left me, and I'm just, oh, I'm down there with you now. And that rise and fall emotionally for me, it's exhausting. And what I kind of had to come to the conclusion of is I have to release control of their situation, right? They're in control. I'm gonna let them own it. I'm gonna let them own their choices. And I'm gonna have to try and find a way to like own my part of it, right? I will be here for you. I will love you. I will listen to you. I will create all the plans you want. I will confront you, right? Like, I will confront you if you are off or if you are lying to yourself. Like, it's weird. Like, I can hear somebody's addict brain talking, you know, and it is, and the more you're aware of this stuff, you'll hear the person and they'll say something that's, well, I can't, oh, you know, I just can't get rid of, you know, I can't get rid of this friend, you know, they're going to kill themselves if I, you know, don't hang out with them. Well, that person's giving you drugs. Like, I can say you're going to relapse because of that person. I can tell them definitively and point blank, and it won't even matter, right? Sometimes they have to fall and do it again. And I do my best to kind of remain at that level. And I think in a lot of ways, my faith does, you know, really help, because I'm not in control of anybody else's salvation, right? All I can do is just show up. I can share the gospel. I can try and disciple them. And either they buy it or they don't. It's not up to me. And in a lot of ways, that's just part of the struggle of getting into this career. And to be honest, a lot of counselors burn out because of that very thing. So yeah, fantastic question. And I think every counselor's journey is a little different with that. But I had one guy who overcame meth addiction. And I mean, it was just one of the most just fantastic, right? He got into a church, right? Just kind of back to that question of like, you know, we don't want to hinder anybody's progress into the community. We encouraged it, and he got into the community, met a young woman, and he got engaged, and he was sober for over a year. And then they found him dead on the side of the road not long after. And I made the mistake of going to his, you know, little kind of funeral page where everybody was writing all the messages about him. And that's as devastated as I've ever been, where that people were writing about literally how amazing this guy had been, what an amazing community member. And to this day, they didn't know if it was drug related. Maybe he had used meth so long that, you know, his body gave out in another way. I don't know. But it's more typical that a relapse will take somebody out, because they'll be sober for so long, their tolerance will go down, and then they'll go right back to using what they used to. And it's way, your body's, you know, it's too shocking for it. So yeah, it's awful. It's really awful. Too many horrible stories for sure. But just about 8.
Yeah, I think so. Any other final questions?
One more?
It might sound a little indirect, but one of the slides you put up mentioned sexual immorality and sensuality. And I'm wondering if there's like what the difference, maybe you don't know exactly how to answer this question, but I'm wondering what the difference is. And the reason why I want to bring it up is because I think sometimes we have like socially acceptable addictions.
Yeah.
I just get this feeling that maybe sensuality, I don't know, does that mean, what does that mean? Or I don't know if you have any.
I don't have an immediate answer. I like nerding out and looking at Greek and really digging into these words. I would refer you to your pastors for a deeper understanding of the topic. And I think I like that concept, though, is like, how do I understand, right? Is this sin that I'm indulging, or am I addicted to? And that's the concept of being filled with the Holy Spirit, right? If the Holy Spirit's in me, I know. I know what it is, right? Maybe it's food. I know if I'm going too far. I might be ignoring it, and I might have a neural pathway that makes that real easy, but I'm still not absolved of the sin, right? I still choose to engage the sin, so I must then choose to confront it. And that's the beauty of community, right? If you have safety within your community, share it, right? Being like, I'm feeling a little sensual today, you know? What's that about, right? Is that wrong? I don't know. You know, you get it out there, and maybe somebody's like, yeah, that's wrong. That's not good. That's sexual immorality. You're like, oh, crap, you know, here we go. Let's deal with it, you know? So I think, you know, that sounds very oversimplified, but I think in a way that our communities, the Holy Spirit, I do think we have all the pieces in place to navigate those things. But the truly hard thing to do is to say the thing you're most ashamed of, to say that thing that you've been hiding for so long. And so if you need to use somebody like me to get the ball rolling, fantastic. But I will kick you right back out into your community. And if all goes well, you're going to be sharing that same thing with them. And they're going to keep you accountable because they only see me once a week, you know? So, yeah, thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for your questions and your willingness to be open-minded learners.